All right, let's jump right in, shall we? Today's deep dive is all about gastroparesis, which is a pretty big deal when you're prepping for that SCE gastroenterology exam. We've got some hefty research here, and we're going to squeeze all the good stuff out of it for you.
It can be a tricky one, that's for sure, especially when you're trying to nail down the diagnosis and get the treatment plan just right.
Right, and we'll hit on all that. But first, can you believe that something like 80% of gastroparesis cases are women?
It's definitely a condition that seems to have a preference.
Yeah.
We'll talk about why that might be later.
Okay. For those who need a quick refresher, what exactly is gastroparesis?
So it's a motility disorder, chronic, of course, where the stomach just doesn't empty as quickly as it should. And the key here is that there's no mechanical blockage.
Ah, so it's not like there's like a physical roadblock in there.
Nope. It's more like the signals are all messed up, so the stomach muscles aren't contracting the way they should be.
So what kind of symptoms will our patients be describing if they have this?
Oh, you know, the usual suspects. They feel full really quickly, like way too soon after starting to eat.
Okay, so early satiety. Got it.
Yeah. And then often nausea, sometimes vomiting, that feeling of being bloated, and sometimes pain as well.
So pretty general digestive complaints. How do we know it's gastroparesis we should be thinking about and not something else?
Good question. You have to really look at the pattern, like how often it's happening. Is it always after meals? And, you know, whether these symptoms are really measuring with their quality of life.
Right, because we all get an upset stomach now and then, but this is like persistent and really impactful.
Exactly. And, you know, keep an eye out for weight loss, especially if it's significant, because that could mean it's a more severe case.
Oh, got it. Weight loss is a red flag. Now, let's say we're suspecting gastroparesis. How do we confirm it? What's the gold standard test?
Gastric emptying scintigraphy. That's your go-to.
Ah, yeah, that rings a bell. Remind me how that works again.
You give the patient a meal, but it's got this radioactive tracer in it, and then you track how much of it is still stuck in the stomach after 4 hours.
Okay.
And if there's more than 10% still hanging out after that time, then boom, you've got your diagnosis of gastroparesis.
Oh, that's helpful. So 10% is the magic number to remember.
Well, there's another magic number, actually. Anything over 35% retained, that's considered severe gastroparesis. Good to know for the SCE exam.
Gotcha. Those percentages are definitely going in my notes. Now, what about if a patient can't do the scintigraphy for whatever reason? What are our other options?
Well, you could try the 13C octanoic acid breath test, which is nice because it's non-invasive.
I vaguely remember that one.
Yeah. So basically you measure how fast the body breaks down this special fatty acid, and that gives you an idea of how well the stomach's emptying.
Okay. That makes sense.
And then there's also the wireless motility capsule, which is pretty cool. It's like that.
Yeah.
This little device the patient swallows, and it travels through their GI tract, measuring all kinds of things like pH and pressure.
Wow, technology is wild.
It is, but don't forget, sometimes the simplest tools are still the best, like an endoscopy.
Right, that good old upper GI endoscopy.
Yeah, it's not specifically for gastroparesis, but it's really important to rule out any kind of physical blockage that might be mimicking those symptoms.
Okay, that makes sense. We got to cover all our bases.
Yeah.
So let's say we've ruled everything else out, we've done our tests, and we're confident it's gastroparesis. Now, I remember from the research that there are different types of gastroparesis, right?
That's right. You've got your diabetic gastroparesis, which makes up a good chunk of the cases, about 30 to 40%.
Okay, so directly related to poorly controlled diabetes.
Yep. But then you've got this big old category called idiopathic gastroparesis, which is about 36%.
Wait, so we don't even know what causes it in over a third of cases?
Nope, it's a mystery, and that's why it's so important to be really thorough in your workup.
Gotcha. You got to rule everything else out before you say, well, we just don't know.
Okay.
Now, help me understand this. How does this all happen? Like, what's actually going wrong in the body to cause gastroparesis?
So think of it this way. It's like the communication system between the brain and the stomach is all messed up.
Okay.
You know, the enteric nervous system, which is like the gut's own little brain, or the vagus nerve, which is the main line connecting the brain to the gut. When those aren't working right,
things get wonky.
Exactly. The contractions that move food through the digestive tract get all uncoordinated, and that's when you start seeing those delays in emptying.
And in the case of diabetic gastroparesis, it's like that high blood sugar is further damaging those nerves.
Right, adding insult to injury.
That makes a lot of sense. So now let's talk about what we can actually do about this. How do we treat gastroparesis?
Well, like with a lot of GI conditions, we start with lifestyle.
Right, got to cover those bases first.
Yeah, so diet is key here. We want patients eating small, frequent meals throughout the day and sticking to low-fat, low-fiber foods that are easier to digest.
Okay, smaller, more frequent, and easier to break down. Makes sense. But what about medications? I know prokinetics are a big deal here.
Oh yeah, prokinetics are our bread and butter when it comes to gastroparesis. They help to kickstart those stomach muscles and get things moving again.
Okay, can we do a quick run through of the main ones? I'm sure that'll come up on the exam.
Absolutely. So first up, you've got metoclopramide.
Metoclopramide, got it. How's that one work?
It's a dopamine receptor antagonist. Basically, it blocks dopamine in the gut, which helps to speed up gastric emptying.
Sounds good, but I'm guessing there's a but here.
There always is, right? The big thing with metoclopramide is the risk of extrapyramidal side effects, things like tremors and muscle rigidity, and in the long term, even tardive dyskinesia, which is a serious movement disorder.
Yeah, those are not side effects we want to mess with. So
Yeah.
metoclopramide is a bit of a double-edged sword.
It is, so we use it cautiously. Now, another option is domperidone.
Domperidone, okay. Different mechanism.
Slightly different. It's also a dopamine antagonist, but it works primarily on the periphery, so it has a lower risk of those central nervous system side effects.
Okay, so easier on the brain. But there's got to be a catch, right?
There is. With domperidone, you have to watch out for QT prolongation, which can mess with the heart rhythm.
So trading one set of risks for another. Gotcha. Any other prokinetics worth mentioning?
We've got erythromycin, which might surprise you because it's actually an antibiotic.
All right. I only think of it for infections.
Well, it turns out that erythromycin can also act as a motilin receptor agonist, meaning it stimulates those gut muscles to contract.
Interesting. So erythromycin, multi-talented.
It is, but it's more of a short-term solution because of tachyphylaxis, which means it can lose its effectiveness over time.
Okay, so not a long-term fix. Got it. Now, what about just managing those uncomfortable symptoms? I'm thinking specifically about nausea, which can be really debilitating.
Oh, absolutely. For nausea, we often turn to antiemetics, like ondansetron.
Ondansetron, good old Zofran. That makes sense.
Yep, it's very effective at controlling nausea and vomiting.
So, a good tool to have in our arsenal for symptom relief. But I'm guessing we shouldn't rely on medications alone.
Right. Medications are just one piece of the puzzle. You have to address the underlying cause, the lifestyle factors, and the whole patient, really.
Makes sense. It's
Yeah.
got to be a holistic approach.
All right, welcome back. We're going to keep digging into this whole gastroparesis thing, and this time we're going to go a little deeper.
Sounds good to me. Let's do it. Where do we start?
Well, let's talk about diabetic gastroparesis because, it's a pretty common complication of diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, and it can really make things complicated for these patients.
Right, we touched on it briefly before, but let's unpack it a little more. What makes diabetic gastroparesis different from other types?
It all comes down to the underlying mechanism. So, with diabetic gastroparesis, what's happening is that the high blood sugar, over time, it starts to damage the vagus nerve.
Ah, the vagus nerve. That's that like super highway connecting the brain and the gut, right?
Exactly. And when that nerve gets damaged, the communication gets all messed up, and that leads to, the delayed gastric emptying, the symptoms, the whole nine yards.
So it's like diabetes is adding another layer of dysfunction on top of everything else.
Yeah, pretty much. And it means that managing these patients can be a bit of a juggling act because you have to balance the diabetes control with the gastroparesis treatment.
Right, you're tackling two problems at once.
Exactly. Now, let's switch gears for a second, talk about something that I know they love to throw at you on the SCE exam refractory gastroparesis. You know, those cases where you've tried everything, diet, meds, the whole shebang, but the patient is still miserable.
Yeah, those are tough ones. So, what do we do when our usual tricks aren't working?
Well, we've got a few more advanced options up our sleeves. One you should definitely know for the exam is gastric electrical stimulation, or GES for short.
GES, okay. Remind me how that works.
So basically, it involves implanting a little device that sends electrical impulses to the stomach muscles.
So it's like giving the stomach a little zap to get it moving again.
Yeah, kind of. And it can be really helpful for some patients, but it's not a cure-all. It's more about improving symptoms and quality of life.
Right. It's not fixing the underlying problem, but it's making things more bearable. So GES is one option. What else have we got?
Well, if GES isn't appropriate or it's not working, we might consider surgery. One procedure you might see on the exam is a pyloromyotomy.
Pyloromyotomy, that's a mouthful. What does that involve?
It's basically cutting the pyloric muscle, which is the muscle that controls the opening between the stomach and the small intestine.
So you're making that opening wider.
Exactly. And that can help food empty from the stomach more easily. And then, you know, in extreme cases, if a patient is really struggling to get enough nutrition, we might have to resort to a jejunostomy feeding tube.
Right. That's where you're bypassing the stomach altogether and delivering nutrients directly to the small intestine.
Yep, that's it. Okay, let's talk about nausea for a minute, because that can be a real beast for gastroparesis patients.
Oh, for sure. Nausea can really knock you down.
It can. So, obviously, we want to address the underlying gastroparesis, but we can also use antiemetics for symptom relief.
Right, our trusty antiemetics. Which ones are we reaching for in this case?
Ondansetron is a good one. It blocks those serotonin receptors that are involved in nausea and vomiting.
Okay, so hitting those nausea pathways from a different angle. But I imagine we still have to be mindful of side effects, right?
Of course. Every medication has its risks and benefits, and we always want to weigh those carefully. And it's important to remember that antiemetics are treating the symptom, not the underlying problem.
Right. Symptom control is important, but we can't forget about the big picture. Now, you mentioned side effects. I know some of those prokinetics, like metoclopramide, can have some pretty nasty ones.
Yeah.
What are the big things to watch out for there?
Metoclopramide, yeah, that one can be tricky. It can cause those extrapyramidal symptoms like, you know, tremors and muscle stiffness. And in the long term, there's that risk of tardive dyskinesia, which is a movement disorder that can be really debilitating.
Yeah, that's not something you want to mess with. So yeah. We got to use that one carefully.
Absolutely. Start low, go slow, and monitor closely. Now, speaking of things we got to be careful with, let's talk about vasors.
Vasors, those are those like weird masses that can form in the stomach, right?
Yep, that's them. Basically, they're like clumps of undigested material, kind of like a hairball, but made of food or fiber or medications.
Ooh, that sounds unpleasant. How do those even form?
Well, in gastroparesis, that slow gastric emptying creates the perfect conditions for vasors to form. Food just sits there in the stomach and it starts to clump together.
Ah, so it's like the longer it sits there, the more likely it is to solidify into a vasor.
Exactly. And those vasors can cause all sorts of problems, like blocking the digestive tract, causing ulcers, even bleeding.
Okay, that's not good. How do we deal with those?
Usually we can remove them with an endoscopy.
Ah, the trusty endoscope.
Yep. Sometimes we can even break them up or dissolve them with medications, but often it's a matter of going in there and physically removing the vasor.
It's like a little excavation project inside the stomach. Now, we've talked a lot about the physical stuff, but I imagine gastroparesis can take a toll mentally and emotionally too, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about it. You're constantly dealing with nausea, bloating, pain. You can't eat normally. It can be really isolating and frustrating.
Yeah, it's not just a physical condition. It affects your whole life.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to address the psychological impact as well. We need to listen to our patients, validate their experiences, and offer support. And sometimes we might need to refer them to a mental health professional.
Right. It's about treating the whole person, not just the symptoms. Now, let's talk about another group that needs special consideration. Pregnant women.
Oh, yeah. Pregnancy can definitely throw a wrench in the works when it comes to gastroparesis.
Why is that? What makes pregnancy such a risky time for gastroparesis?
Well, those pregnancy hormones, especially progesterone, they relax smooth muscle all over the body, including the stomach.
So it's like pregnancy is slowing down an already sluggish stomach.
Exactly. Plus, pregnancy can increase the risk of other things that can mimic gastroparesis, like GERD and gallstones.
So diagnosis can be tricky.
It can be. And we also have to be really careful with treatment because some medications aren't safe during pregnancy.
Right. You've got two patients to think about.
Exactly. Now, before we move on, I want to stress something that's super important, both for your exam and for good patient care, a multidisciplinary approach.
So it's not just the gastroenterologist going it alone.
Nope, not at all. We need a whole team of experts to really manage these patients effectively. So, you know, we might need a dietitian to help with those dietary modifications, an endocrinologist if the patient has diabetes, a psychologist if there are mental health concerns.
So it's like recognizing that gastroparesis affects so many different aspects of a person's life.
Exactly. And a multidisciplinary team allows us to address all those aspects and provide truly holistic care.
I like that. Holistic care. It's about seeing the whole person, not just the disease.
That's it. All right. I think that's a good place to pause for now. We've covered a ton of ground, but there's still more to come. We'll wrap things up in the final part of our deep dive, and I promise we'll leave you feeling ready to tackle anything that comes your way, whether it's on the exam or in your practice.
Okay. We're back for the final round of our gastroparesis deep dive. We've covered a lot of ground, but there are still a few things, a few key points that we need to hit, especially if you're getting ready for that SCE exam.
You got it. We've talked about the basics, the complications, the tough cases. Now it's time to really fine-tune our approach, you know, focus on those decision-making points that often trip people up on the exam.
Okay, I'm ready. What do we need to know?
Let's talk prokinetics. We know they're essential for managing gastroparesis, but choosing the right one for each patient, well, that can be a bit of an art, you know, both in real life and on those test questions.
Right, because we've got a few to choose from, like metoclopramide, domperidone, erythromycin, and they all have their own quirks.
Exactly. Each one works a little differently and has its own set of potential side effects.
So how do we decide which one to use? What factors are we considering?
It's all about personalized medicine, really. You got to look at the whole their medical history, other meds they're taking, their preferences, all that. There's no magic formula here.
Right. It's like putting a puzzle together, considering all the pieces.
That's a good way to put it. For example, you wouldn't want to use metoclopramide in someone with Parkinson's disease. Right.
Oh, right, because it could make their neurological symptoms worse. Makes sense.
Exactly. Or if a patient has a history of QT prolongation, domperidone would be off the table because it carries that risk of, you know, dangerous arrhythmias.
So we've got to be thinking about neurological risks, cardiac risks. It's a lot to keep in mind.
It is. And then, of course, there's the patient's own preferences. Some people might prefer a medication they only have to take once a day, while others might be really concerned about a specific side effect.
So it's really important to have that conversation with the patient, explain the options, and make the decision together.
Absolutely. Shared decision making is key. And sometimes, you know, it takes a bit of trial and error to find the right fit.
Right. You might start with one prokinetic and then adjust the dose or switch to a different one if it's not working out.
Exactly. It's an ongoing process.
Mm.
Now, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the future. There's a lot of exciting research happening in the world of gastroparesis, stuff that you might even see hinted at on the exam.
Ooh, I love hearing about the cutting edge stuff. What's on the horizon?
Well, one area that's really hot right now is the gut microbiome.
The gut microbiome, everyone's favorite topic these days.
Right. We're learning more and more about how those trillions of bacteria in our gut can impact our health, and it's looking like they might play a role in gastroparesis as well.
So the idea is that, like, an imbalance in the gut microbiome could be contributing to these motility problems.
That's the theory. It's still early days. But if it pans out, it could open up some totally new treatment options, you know, things like targeted probiotics or even fecal microbiota transplantation.
Wow, that would be amazing. So manipulating the gut bacteria to help with gastroparesis, that's pretty mind-blowing. What else is in the pipeline?
Well, researchers are also working on developing new prokinetics that are more targeted and have fewer side effects.
That would be a huge win for patients. More effective medications without all the baggage.
Exactly. And then there's stem cell therapy, which is, well, it's still pretty futuristic, but there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, stem cells are like the wild card of medicine these days. They seem to hold promise for everything.
Right. And in the case of gastroparesis, the idea is that you could use stem cells to repair those damaged nerves in the gut.
So essentially, you're rewiring that communication system between the brain and the stomach.
Pretty much. It's a long way off, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
It is. It's incredible to think about what the future holds for gastroparesis treatment. Well, I think we've reached the end of our deep dive. We've gone from the basics to the cutting edge, and I feel like we've covered just about everything you need to know to tackle gastroparesis, whether it's on the SCE exam or in your everyday practice.
I think so, too. You know, gastroparesis can be a really challenging condition, both for patients and for the clinicians who treat them. But the more we learn about it, the better equipped we are to provide the best possible care.
Absolutely. It's all about knowledge, right? The more we know, the better we can help our patients. So to everyone listening, best of luck on your exams and keep up the great work out there.
Until next time.